Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of my favorite authors to appear on the show is nature writer Cy Montgomery. The New Hampshire-based author has written some great books about wildlife, including The Soul of an Octopus, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. In her latest book, Montgomery takes on a bird that's known well to all of us, the chicken. But what do most of us really know about the lives of chickens? Unless you spend a lot of time and are an astute observer of animal intelligence and behavior like Cy, probably not very much. Cy's new book is What the Chicken Knows, A New Appreciation of the World's Most Familiar Bird. In it, she describes life with chickens on her small New Hampshire farm, and some of her discoveries over time might surprise you. Chickens have very distinctive talents and personalities. They're the evolutionary link to the dinosaurs and highly adapted to life with humans. As we'll hear, they are way more than just a means of making omelets for breakfast or chicken tenders on your dinner plate. Chickens, it turns out, are really amazing creatures. To find out more about them, we're joined by poultry fancier and fabulous writer Cy Montgomery. Cy, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Before we get into your new book and talk about chickens, I'd like to know more about you, because you've written so many interesting... How many books have you written now?
I think it is 38 as far as the ones that are published. There's a couple in the pipeline that are written or fixing to get written that are coming out soon, but new books this year.
Wow. Well, my personal favorites was Soul of an Octopus was beautiful, and The Hawk's Way was really cool. Enjoyed that. And I really like this new book. So what I'm really curious about is there's the chicken and the egg question. What came first for you? Like, how did your interest in animals and writing come together?
Well, animals came first before I even had words. I was born in Germany, and my parents took me as a little toddler before I was two to the Frankfurt Zoo. And as often happens, the little toddler got loose from the parents. And when my parents found me, I was in the hippo pen with the hippos. So I've always kind of felt like these were my people. And when I was old enough to speak, I told my mother that she should just stop trying to make me be a little girl, because I was actually a horse. And she went to the pediatrician, who assured her I'd grow out of it. And I did, when I realized I was actually a dog. So I have always, always felt the connection with other species. But it was when I began to read that I realized I might be able to help animals with my own writing. And that's what I've been doing my whole life. And it is, so far, a real blast.
And you live in New England, in New Hampshire, correct?
Yes.
And you live on in a rural area where you can have animals. So they're really a part of your everyday life.
Yes. At one point, we had a 750-pound pig who lived to be, oh gosh, is he 14 when he died of old age in his sleep? And being in New England, we have town meeting. And at town meeting, in fact, every time we had any kind of a vote, he got write-in votes for public office. He was so beloved.
Oh, wow. It's so interesting, you know, when I read your work, because it's so easy to fall into a trap of anthropomorphizing animals and, you know, just and trying to make them human when they aren't. They're different. They have personalities, they have emotions, and they have thoughts. They are sentient beings, but they're not people.
Exactly.
It's an interesting line to walk, I would think, for you as a writer trying to, you know, navigate that. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I totally can. I mean, from the moment we got our first puppy, when I was a little tiny girl, I never dressed her up in baby clothes. I never pushed her around in a pram. I realized that even though she was younger than I was, she was more advanced in knowledge than I was. She possessed senses I don't have. She could hear the tiniest sound to which I was oblivious. She could smell scents that, you know, I knew nothing about. She could see in the dark, thanks to her tapetum lucidum in the back of the eye. And she could run faster than I was. In fact, in just about every measure, she was a superior to me, and I was her student, and she was the teacher. And that's how I've always felt about animals. I go in there with beginner's mind. I try not to project onto them something I need, because I don't need them to be this way or that way. We do this with each other, of course, you know. I mean, who hasn't asked someone out who was not interested in dating you, or gotten somebody a present that you thought would be great and they hated it? We miscalculate in our relationships with other humans, and of course we do so with animals as well. But I think the larger error, the far more serious error, worse by far than anthropomorphism, is anthropocentrism, the idea that only humans possess the ability to remember the past or think about the future or have emotions. I mean, we all think, feel, and know. But as you point out, we think, feel, and know different things.
Yeah, and certainly that doesn't mean that they don't, because they have their own way of a worldview of their own. It's, you know,
absolutely,
evolved over millions of years. And with dogs, you know, in that, with the case of dogs, you know, that's evolved, co-evolved with humans, because they're such a part of our lives. But it's interesting to me, you know, the older I get and the more time I spend with animals, just to try to see the world through, you know, their point of view instead of mine. And I think when you do that, you realize animals have a lot to teach us.
It really opens up your world, doesn't it? I mean, it opens up your heart to compassion. It opens up your senses to senses you do not have. And whenever we meet someone unlike ourselves, we have a great opportunity for growth. And I feel bad for people who only have friends of one species. That would be like if you only had friends who were your own age, or you only had friends who lived on your block. You know, that we would, that's just an impoverished existence.
Not a very enriching way to live.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny. I was thinking about you this morning. This might sound odd. I was looking across the street, and there was a group of turkey vultures, California turkey vultures, and they're feeding on the carcass of a deer that probably, sadly, probably got hit by a car and was wounded and died there. That's my best guess. But, you know, that might sound gross to people and everything, but I go out there and I look, and I haven't walked over there and, you know, stayed a respectful distance so I didn't bother them. And I just told them, hey, thanks, guys. You know, they're the local cleanup crew. And if it wasn't for them, you know, our neighborhood would have all kinds of yucky stuff that they look after, you know, and clean up. They're sanitary engineers for the neighborhood.
You're so right. And there's lots of other cultures that realize that. And in fact, in some cultures, sky burial is a thing, to take the corpses of our dead. The most respectful thing in these cultures is to take the corpses of our dead, put them high up in the sky, and let them be part of the cycle of life by feeding a magnificent bird.
Yeah. Well, we definitely have, I would say, if there's one overarching problem with modern society, it's our disconnect from the natural world. We have so many people that are so disconnected. They don't experience nature. They don't really understand what animal life is all about. And they're just, you know, they're so focused on their indoor lives, whereas I prefer to be outdoor.
Oh, me too. Totally so. Yeah. And it kills me, because we really are very well equipped to understand other animals, because until very recently in our evolution, we were all hunter-gatherers. And your life literally depended on observing the natural world. So every cell of our body has been sculpted through millions of years of evolution to live in this sweet green breathing world around us. But instead of hunter-gatherers, very recently we turned into shopper-gatherers. And this, I think, names the source of a lot of our discontent.
Yeah, the acquisition of things instead of experiences.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your new book. Because when I first saw it, I thought, oh, that looks kind of interesting. And of course, it's by Cy Montgomery, so I'm going to probably really enjoy it. and I started to read it, and I realized, we really have all of these preconceived notions about chickens, that they're dumb. They don't have feelings. They're just, you know, these dumb birds, and they squabble all the time. And they just, you know, they're kind of mindless birds, and they're all they're good for is eating and eating their eggs or their flesh. But boy, you know, from page one, when I started to read this book, I realized it's like, there's a lot about chickens I had no idea. So let's get into chickens. Why did you decide you wanted to write this book about chickens?
Well, chickens are the one bird that everyone can identify. I mean, there's folks that can't tell a robin from a crow, but they can tell a chicken because it looks just like the guy in the Kellogg's cornflakes box, you know? They are instantly recognized by everyone. There are four chickens on Earth for every human, so there's lots of them around. And it's a great way to get to know another mind. They're right here among us. A lot of people adopted chickens during the pandemic, and many folks just fell in love with all the individuals in their flock. But there's other cases in which people went back to work and just dumped their chickens, sometimes in the woods.
Oh, my.
And that's another reason that I was delighted this book came out now, because we do need to appreciate these birds. And this common creature that everyone thinks they know is actually a fabulous source of wildness and wonder and a way to expand your heart.
Yeah, my neighbors have chickens. I don't keep chickens, but my neighbors do. And when they go out of town, they have me take care of the chickens. And
oh,
so
awesome.
Over the last year, I've gotten to know, you know, those birds a bit, and they know me. It's interesting, you know, they can hear the gate open, and I can hear, you know, as soon as I start to open the gate, you know, they start clucking at me like they know, oh, he's coming to bring us some cool stuff, because I was getting scraps from the kitchen. But it's funny because I can hear them, and it's like, oh, yep, they know I'm coming.
Yeah. And you know what? If you sent someone they hadn't met, they might not behave that way, because chickens have been tested and we know that they recognize at least 100 different faces.
Wow.
And They look at each other's faces the way we look at each other's faces to decide, is this the individual? I mean, if I ran into you on the street, it wouldn't matter if you were wearing a black coat or a white coat or a hat. I'd still know it was you. But if you were wearing a mask, I would have trouble. Well, scientists who are used to playing tricks on their subjects actually did an experiment in which they disguised a bunch of chickens in different ways to see how they recognize each other. And that's how they discovered, if you start messing with their face, chickens won't recognize each other. But you can change the color of their feathers, that you can put on a little coat over their feathers, you can clip off some of the feathers, and they will still recognize each other if they can look in their faces. And they recognize human faces very easily.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Cy Montgomery as we discuss her new book, What the Chicken Knows, A New Appreciation of the World's Most Familiar Bird. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with Cy Montgomery as we discuss the lives of chickens. In the beginning of the book, and this is what kind of floored me, I found this really interesting, is we've had some experiences in my family. Grandma keeps chickens, and she's had a few incidences where, you know, reaching into the chicken coop to do whatever, where a rooster has, you know, clawed her, you know, and used his spurs or whatever, you know, ripped her hand open. And so roosters can be kind of scary to me. And then I was reading in your book that, oh, there's a way. If you have an ornery rooster, there's a way to deal with them. and it's not definitely not kicking them. I definitely learned that that's a bad idea. Tell us about how you learned to deal with ornery roosters.
Yeah, this is astonishing. And it just shows how, you know, when you're traveling in the chicken universe, you can keep learning and learning and learning. I had kept a flock for over 20 years before I learned this from a neighbor living catty-cornered across the street. Her name is Ashley Nagley, and she has a rooster rescue. And lots of people dump their roosters because roosters do sometimes turn on you and they attack and they run at you with their spurs. And I've had that happen. In fact, it was quite embarrassing one time when our rooster Clarence attacked the minister. I was a deaconess in the church, and I'd been very good friends with him and his wife. And his wife tragically died, but much later, he fell in love and was going to get married again and goes to bring his fiance and her two small children to Cyan Howard's friendly farm for a nice day. And I'd never met Kathy before or her kids, so I really wanted them to enjoy this trip. Well, the pig, who was 750 pounds with razor sharp tusks, comes bucking out. Kathy was alarmed. The children, one of them began to cry. But then Graham saw the chickens and said, well, here's someone more your size. Let's pet the nice chicken. So he goes to stroke her, which I do all the time. And you start at the head and you go down the back and the shoulders, and then you swoop up on the tail just like you would with a cat. Well, often the chicken will then do a thing called a sex crouch. It squats down. And this is what they do in order to make it easier for a rooster to mount them. So the minister was doing this to the chicken while Clarence the rooster spied this from across the barnyard. And he came flying at the minister like a bat out of you know where and attacked with his spurs. And Graham was wearing shorts and it bloodied his legs. The children were horrified. I gave them each an egg to try to make the day end on a happy note, but I later learned the eggs broke in the back seat and stained the upholstery of the car. So a complete failure.
Oh, my.
But had I known what to do, this would not have happened. But Ashley, my neighbor, told me the absolutely counterintuitive way you deal with a rowdy rooster is that when you have a rooster attacking you, you do not run away. You do not try to block him or kick him. What you do is you pick him up and cuddle him and carry him around in your arms for a while. And this really works. I have seen it work. I have met the roosters in her care. They are the most lovely gentlemen you could ever hope to meet. They love to be cuddled. They love to come in the house. They enjoy watching her husband repair cars with such intensity that you think that they're going to go try to do exactly what he did right afterwards. I mean, they're really paying attention. And they bring her thoughtful little gifts like gaskets and nails. And they're just the nicest roosters. And you would never dream that every single one of them was just dumped off somewhere unwanted.
Because they were aggressive originally. And
yes.
And I know in the case with my neighbor, JT, they had a rooster that was a problem rooster. And so they found somebody that had a big chicken farm that wanted more roosters. So, you know, it worked out.
Yeah, that's what we did. We gave our rooster to another chicken farm. They were beautiful roosters, but they were dangerous. We've also had roosters that didn't turn. We had Lakenvelder roosters who were very, very gentle. But then one day they just keeled over and died. And this is very interesting, too. I discovered that roosters generally live shorter lives than the hens by quite a bit, and their physiology is quite different.
What is it that they about their physiology that causes them to have such early mortality?
Well, their hearts don't beat at the same rate. I mean, they just, you know, though, interestingly, if you look statistically at male and female humans also tend to live longer.
This is true. That is something I do know. Okay, well, that really does sound counterintuitive, that a chicken's attacking me, so I'll cuddle him.
Right. I mean, can you imagine our criminal justice system completely redone?
Well, yeah. Well, there's some scary people out there. I don't know that I would want to go cuddle with, but a rooster. I might be game to try that.
Yeah, I'm down with that. Now she does say it's wise if you have a towel to cuddle it with a towel because those spurs are big, and also you don't want to. You really don't want to hold any bird too close to your eyes, face. For example. Mm-hmm. They don't try to peck your eyes out, but your eyes are shiny. And many birds will peck at and investigate shiny things. And just the other day, I had a chicken peck at my teeth, and it was because they were shiny and because I was smiling.
Oh, wow. And that brings up another interesting thing that I read in your book about chickens is chickens and blood. And the red dot experiment, can talk about that a bit, because that's really fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, chickens listen to their instinct a whole lot. And instinct is generally a good thing. It's your ancestors basically advising you through your genes that, you know, through eons of existence, when we did this, it mostly worked. And you sometimes get behaviors that seem stupid. And under a certain circumstance, they are stupid, but they mostly work. Well, one of those behaviors, which is instinctive in chickens, is if they see blood, they peck at it. And this might be because meat is a real delicacy for a lot of birds. And if you have a chance to eat some meat, you better not let that chance pass you by because it's full of protein and really good for you. But it's not so great if your flock mate has an injury because the rest of the flock is going to peck at that bloody injury often until the flock mate is so badly off that you can't save them. And this is so well known in the poultry industry that there's a product called Stop Peck that you can apply to these wounds that apparently tastes awful and prevents chickens from pecking at other injured chickens.
And as I recall reading, they'll actually just go after like a little red dot thinking, oh, that could be blood.
Yeah, it's true. And as you know, most birds have excellent vision. So they have great color vision. They may see colors that we don't even know about. So who knows how enticing that red dot might look to the eyes of a bird.
It made me think of a whole new use I could have for a chicken because my recording setup, it has a red dot on it that you press to get it to record. So I could get a chicken in here and say, and just show them the red dot and say, okay, here we go. Start the show.
Yeah. I think that's a great idea. In fact, people have trained pigeons to peck over and over again at a control, for example, and they will do it and they won't get bored and they focus on it. You know, it's not like a person that will just start thinking about, you know, their to-do list at home or, you know, their hair appointment or their kid's soccer game. Pigeons actually can be deployed in this way and they make excellent workers. So think about a pigeon, too.
Huh. Well, you also you gave me an idea or taught me something when I went to go see the chickens yesterday morning. I opened the gate and I heard them clucking at me and I said, hello, ladies. And that's the first time I ever used that expression. And I got that from your book. So tell us about the ladies.
Well, my ladies had their own culture in my flock. I did not really realize that my flock was different from other flocks. But it is, just like every human community is slightly different from every other human community. My ladies were just calm and peaceful and loving. There was not a lot of pecking. There was not a lot of squabbles. There wasn't always someone running around with a whole bunch of missing feathers. Even their molts, when they lose and replace their feathers, were not like these dramatic, messy affairs. And I discovered just how peaceful they were when we got a new tenant in our house, and she had a flock of chickens. And her flock was totally different from my flock. She called hers the Rangers. And the Rangers were drama queens. Everything they did was so dramatic. And they were quite aggressive. In fact, they were basically giving my birds the finger through the fence. She had a nice run for her chickens. My chickens were free to roam wherever they wanted all day long, except at night I locked them in. And she would only let her rangers out of their run when my chickens were away. But even so, my chickens were so appalled by the behavior of the rangers that they basically moved out of our yard and just lived in the neighbor's yard all day long, and then would come home at the end of the day to go back in their coop. They could not stand this rude behavior. But I loved the Rangers. They were fabulous. They had a great sense of humor. Elizabeth knew every chicken by name, and each chicken had a different kind of relationship with her. And one would say something to her that the chicken said to no one else. This chicken would go, duff, 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 duff. No other chicken said that. Another one invented a game that no one else played. She would seize a particularly delicious food item and then issue a food call to the rest of the flock. Look over here, I've got something great to eat. Oh, you're going to love this. And then all the other chickens would come running and she would stand back until they were just about to eat the treat and then she'd swallow it. And she obviously thought this was hilarious because she did this all the time. So they were personality plus. But that was when I learned, and at that point, I'd had chickens for over 10 years. You know, at that point, I learned that each flock has its own culture, and that culture will keep going even if the original, every bird in the original flock may be gone, died of old age, but they pass this on to the younger generation. And my younger generation was not related to the other chickens. I didn't hatch out babies. I was ordering these unrelated chickens through the mail. But even so, when they joined my flock, they joined that culture.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, we know there's the expression pecking order. And I'm wondering if you could really explain in terms of chicken culture, what does it really mean?
Well, pecking order, I have found, in my flock anyway, had a lot more to do with order than pecking. And by order, I mean social relationships. Social relationships are so important to chicken life. It is central to their lives. And this is something that we humans value and we should respect in them. And every chicken has a best friend and then like a second best friend. And they almost always roost next to that friend at night. There is also usually a lead chicken. Sometimes it's a rooster if you have one, but if not, there's usually a chicken who is kind of the leader. And like a good leader, they do things like break up squabbles. They will alert the group to something delicious. They will tell you if there's a hawk overhead and you have to worry about this, or if there's a ground predator coming, and is it coming quickly or is it just kind of far away and you should just be aware? So it's not just about bossing other chickens around. With great power comes great responsibility. And in my flock, at least, everyone knew her place and knew how to make the flock a working social unit, best for all.
And you also had a chicken, and I can't remember her name, but she got injured, as I recall, and you kind of had to rehab her inside your house. Can you tell us a bit about that chicken? Because that was really a neat story.
Oh, yeah, she was a sweetheart. Her name was Pickles, and was named Pickles by the little girls who moved in next door. And Pickles had come with other chicks in the mail as little fluffy egg-shaped creatures and grown up in my office until they were strong enough to go outside and be with the rest of the flock. But from the very beginning, she had a little bump on her head, and to my growing horror, I discovered she had a hole in her skull, and this was a bump filled with cerebrospinal fluid. So she was a mentally challenged chicken. So she always seemed kind of a little slow, but that was fine. You know, she didn't need to be the leader of the group. Everyone else was looking out for her. Until one day she kind of wandered off. And when she came back, her head was kind of hanging by a string. She'd been attacked by something or run into some barbed wire. I don't know what had happened to her. But the other chickens, seeing the red blood, thought, you know, gee, we must peck at this. So we took her out of the flock. I took her to the vet. Our vet is a genius, Chuck Davini. And he fashioned for her an Elizabethan collar made out of an X-ray sheet. And she lived in the bathroom for a while until this thing healed. And sometimes I forgot to tell guests who would come over for dinner that if they used the loo, they were going to be observed by a chicken sitting on the sink wearing an Elizabethan collar. But so she did rejoin the flock and she got well. Everybody accepted her again and she lived for many years. And I discovered that she didn't quite peck straight. When she was sick, I was feeding her all different things that would appeal. And for example, I'd put a Cheerio in the palm of my hand, and she'd peck to the side of the Cheerio. She wouldn't hit the Cheerio. And I'd never noticed this before because you'd be eating, you know, out of a trough or a big bunch of stuff. So if you pecked in the general direction, you were likely to get something. But it was then that I realized that she couldn't really see straight either.
Wow. And what did you do to compensate for that? Did you figure out like, well, if I put it just a little bit to the right, she'll get it?
Well, I just put a lot of Cheerios.
Put a lot
there
of stuff
so
out
that,
there.
Yeah. Yeah, she would go for the one to the right and
get one.
She'd get another one. And most of the time, the stuff that you're feeding chickens, it's not just one little thing the size of a Cheerio. You're like throwing out some cracked corn, or you've got, you know, their regular grain rations. Or, you know, if you're bringing them kind of stuff that you might otherwise take to the compost heap, you know, it's kind of a nice mound that they can look at. So she did just fine.
Well, I take the neighbor chickens stuff that's, you know, lettuce that's kind of looking not so great anymore. Sad lettuce goes over to the chickens, things like that. Well, are there things that are particularly they really like? What's some chicken treats?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I used to buy cottage cheese just for them. They love cottage cheese.
Really?
I mean, it's pretty healthy food when you think of it. I mean, it's got fat, but it's got protein and it's got calcium. And they were so sweet. They'd stick their beaks in there and then their beaks would get cottage cheese on it. And then they'd wipe their beaks on my pants.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Cy Montgomery. Her new book, What the Chicken Knows, A New Appreciation of the World's Most Familiar Bird, is a fun, fast read about the domestic birds that are way more interesting than you might have thought. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our interview with author Cy Montgomery. Her new book, What the Chicken Knows, A New Appreciation of the World's Most Familiar Bird, is a fun and fascinating look at the domesticated birds that live in our backyard chicken coops. Can you talk a bit about, you know, chicken language, if we could call it that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, there is a book called How to Speak Chicken. And this is by a friend of mine. Her name is Melissa, and she also has a great blog called Tilly's Nest. And Tilly was her favorite chicken, who I discovered when I met Melissa in Washington, D.C., where one of her previous books was getting an award, as was mine, that her Tilly used this one sound only when Melissa would enter the coop. She never said this when Melissa wasn't there. And she didn't say it like to other chickens. She said it to Melissa. And apparently that was her name. they apparently gave Melissa a name. And it sounded kind of like a trumpet to herald the approach of a queen. It kind of went bah, 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 like that. And they didn't say it for any other reason. And interestingly, Tilly is the one who coined that name. But when Tilly died, other chickens had taken that up and continued to use that word. And there's plenty of animals we now know of that do have names for each other. Dolphins, for example, have individual signature whistles. And there are other birds who apparently have like a last name or a password that they have to say it or their parents won't feed them. And this is to protect essentially the parents against feeding like a cuckoo or one of those nest parasite birds that comes and lays their egg in your nest. And then you end up raising that baby. And often that baby is so big, it kicks out your babies and eats all their food. So it's kind of like a password. Like, are you really my child? Yes, I am. And my name is this. Okay, you can have a worm. Wow. So chickens too. I think, you know, the more we start to understand animals' voices, the more we learn how complex their ways of communicating to each other are. And the more we understand that animals do think and feel and know, and they remember the past so that they can anticipate the future. And if you think about it, this has great adaptive value. It sure helps us. Otherwise, how can you learn anything? And you have to learn if you're an organism that does stuff. So it makes total sense that they can do all of these things. What doesn't make sense is that once we grow up, we buy this lie that humans are the only ones who think and feel and know. But children know better. And interestingly, I recently read a study showing that most humans, even if they haven't had chickens in their lives, if they listen to chicken vocalizations, most humans can tell if that chicken is happy or sad. And this is without any coaching. So I think we know instinctively more than we know in our intellectual mind.
I know, like, from just my own brief experiences with the neighbor chickens, that, you know, I hear them squabbling here and there, you know, so I don't know what's going on over there. So, you know, I can hear something's going on, that they're getting rowdy with each other, and it usually calms down after a bit. But there was one day where Cheryl heard it, and, you know, she raised the alarm to me. Says that doesn't sound like, you know, the normal chicken sounds over there. And then I heard it and I went, oh, that doesn't sound good. So I went over, and sure enough, there was a dog that had gotten in their chicken coop.
Oh my gosh. Wow. I'm so glad Cheryl heard that. Oh
yeah.
No.
And it was like, you know, if she had to get, but she never spends any time with the chickens, but she could tell that this was a different kind of distress call than the usual stuff. The other one that's interesting is the sounds they make when they're laying eggs.
Yes, I know. And it doesn't necessarily just mean ouch. It's hard to know how they feel about their eggs, but at least some chickens certainly seem to feel their egg is a gift. And there was one chicken I read about who every day, same time of day, would peck to have the door to the person's house opened. And the person inside would open the door and the chicken would proceed to the bed of her favorite person, a little boy, hop up on his pillow, lay the egg on the pillow, and then go back to the barnyard.
Wow. So he's literally leaving the little boy a gift.
Yes.
She was. That's
yes,
amazing.
Yes, I love that.
That's
yeah,
amazing.
I totally love that. And, you know, other chickens, they lay an egg, and some feel very possessive about it. And you go to pick up the egg, and they'll peck you. Now, my ladies never did that. They did not peck at me when I went to get their eggs. And I don't know why that is. Maybe because I was an honorary chicken, because I raised them from tiny baby chicks. And unlike many people who put them in a pen or something, they lived in my office and sat on my head and in my sweater and sometimes on my keyboard their whole childhood. And only when they were teenagers did they go outside and join the other chickens. But at that point, as far as they were concerned, I was their mother. So I think that's why they don't peck.
It is interesting because animals do that. If they will imprint on, you know, the first thing that they see and associate that with, oh, this is my caregiver, my parent, and it might not be the same species.
It makes perfect sense 99.9% of the time. Mm-hmm. It's so valuable that it got encoded in their genes, because most of the time, the first moving object you see is your mother. And it's essential. If these birds are, there's two strategies that birds use as youngsters. There's some birds whose young are altricial. And those are like hummingbirds and a lot of songbirds. And they're these like naked little critters with, you know, no feathers, and their eyes aren't even open. And they just open their little baby bird beaks, and they're always crying to be fed. Chickens are the opposite strategy. They're called precocial. And you've heard of precocious children. Uh-huh. And they hatch out of the egg and they can like run like that second. And they can peck and their eyes are open and they've got their down and, you know, they're ready to go. And so it makes a lot of sense for them to instantly recognize that moving object, my mother, I better stay with her.
Oh, yeah. No, that does make sense now that I think about it that way. And another fascinating thing that I've learned about chickens from your book, and something we've thought about, toyed around with the idea of having chickens here a few times, and usually decide not to because the neighbors' cats and our dogs, and we don't want to have anything happen to the chickens, that kind of thing. But in the back of my mind, I would be thinking, well, if I get chickens and I have to keep them in a pen, and if I, you know, I can't let them out, because if I let them out, they'll just disappear off into the neighborhood, into the wild, you know, where they'll leave. But they don't do that, according to your discoveries and what you have experienced. Tell us about chickens knowing where home is.
Yeah, this is amazing, especially to me, because I have a terrible sense of direction. I once got lost in my own backyard as a child, and it wasn't like a big backyard. It was like a quarter acre. It was sad. But chickens have amazing spatial abilities. And in experiments, they've been able to do things like calculate the center of any given patch of ground, even if they've never been there before. And they can do so in the absence of landmarks, even. So I was so afraid when I took my young chickens and put them in with the other chickens that the minute I opened the door, they would just escape into the woods. And no, this didn't happen at all. They immediately discerned the boundaries of my property. In fact, my hens did not cross the road. And my hens, for the longest time, never went over the low stone wall that separated me and the neighbors. That was a vacant house for a long time. And even though there was no one there, they never went over there. It was only when a lovely family moved in, a woman and her two adorable kids, age 7 and 9, they moved in, and Kate and Jane were over our house all the time, and Howard and I were over their house frequently, and the pig was involved, and our dog was always hanging out. And somehow the chickens realized before I did that we two families had become one unit, and they just annexed their property. And that was when they started hanging out in the next door neighbor's yard.
Yeah, it's like, you know, they figured out, okay, well, there's people here now and we like them, so we'll include this as part of our property now.
Yes. And you know what? It was even more sophisticated than I made it sound, because before, you know, the house was vacant for a long time, but there was a nice man before then who lived in the house. And he was a nice neighbor, and we said hello. And if he needed help, we went over to help him. And if we needed help, he came over to, but it wasn't as intimate as, you know, becoming one family. And the whole time he lived there, they never went into his yard. And it certainly had plenty of juicy worms the whole time, but they just didn't go over there. They waited until they were able to perceive that the social situation had changed. So they are just so good at figuring out social relationships and what they mean.
Let's talk about one of the sad things about having chickens is predators. There are a lot of critters out there that, like where you live and where I live, we have foxes here that take neighbor chickens and people's chickens in this neighborhood all the time. It's really a challenge, isn't it, to have, you know, chickens where you're living in that interface where there's wild creatures.
Yeah, absolutely. My husband used to say, if you want to see wildlife in New Hampshire, get some chickens, because our chickens, I mean, during the 20 years that we kept them here on our land with us, we had every imaginable animal eat a chicken. We had foxes. We had an owl who carried one off. We had hawks. We had mink. We had weasel. We had raccoons. We had the neighbor's dog. And we had a bobcat. And these are animals that I could identify because I saw their bodies as they were eating my chicken or carrying my chicken. Or in the case of the owl, I could tell from the snow, from the clues left in the snow. And for a while, you know, this did not happen that often. Our chickens were free to range over our entire 8 acres as long as they wanted. I had a baby monitor so that I could hear them all the time. And if an attack came, I could run outside and often chase away the predator. But in New Hampshire, a wonderful thing has happened in that our woods are recovering and a lot of the native animals who were once here are returning. And used to be, you know, there wasn't a bobcat in your yard, you know. I mean, foxes, there's usually foxes even in suburban neighborhoods. And I love foxes. They are fabulous animals. But, you know, weasels, fishers were once extirpated from the state, as far as I know, and reintroduced so that to restore the balance of nature. We finally had so many predators that I was down to 3 chickens. And one day when I was going out to do a book signing in Concord, I had them all put away because I knew I was going to be off the premises. And I just went in to check, give them some treat before I left. And 2 of them lay dead on the ground, and I could tell a weasel had gotten them. Only 1 chicken was left. And you don't want to be an only chicken. They're flock animals. That's no way to live. I could not leave that chicken either in the barn because a little weasel, we have an old barn with a dirt floor. And as hard as you try, you never can really exclude a weasel from an old barn. So I called up my friend Julie Brown down the street, and she had a flock of chickens I used to take care of like you take care of your neighbor's chickens when she would go away. And I said, Julie, can I bring my hen over to your house? And she said, sure. And she became good friends with 2 of Julie's chickens, and she lived over there for the longest time. And I would still get to see her all the time.
And you happened to be taking care of the chickens when there was a bear encounter, right?
Yes. This was the one predator that they were not prepared to deal with. And I was horrified that this had happened. I showed up one morning to let the chickens out, and I'd closed them up carefully the night before, but they were loose. And I went around and I saw they were loose because a bear had torn off the entire back of their coop.
Wow.
And I don't have the skills to rebuild the coop as well as it was before. And even the way it was before, it was no match for a bear. So I soon realized I have to take her entire flock and get them the heck out of there. But I had our chicken coop, which had not been occupied for several years. And so during the day before the bear could come back that night, I spiffed up our coop, and I first got my chicken and her best friend and put them in a pet carrier and brought them to the chicken coop. And my chicken leapt up to the exact spot on the exact perch that she had always perched on years before. She remembered it instantly, and her best friend, who always wanted to be right beside her, felt like, okay, this is safe. My friend is comfortable here. This is awesome. And so then I moved the rest of the flock in, and everyone was happy. And it was far enough away that the bear didn't know about it. Plus, although it was a not impenetrable to weasels, our coop was impenetrable to bears. So they rebuilt their coop, and they used electric wire around it to repel the bears. And so now their coop is safe, and everyone's back there now.
Yeah, and you saved the flock. So that's a nice note to end on. Si, I really thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you, and I really enjoyed this book, What the Chicken Knows. It was a lot of fun to read, and I learned a lot. So thanks for joining us.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much, and say hello to your flock for me.
Thanks again to our guest, Si Montgomery. You can get her new book, What the Chicken Knows, A New Appreciation of the World's Most Familiar Bird, at most major booksellers, or order it from your local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.